Democracia e liberdade só existe quando a sua respectiva Força Armada assim o quer.
You know I'm totally off script right now.
I want to be nasty. Do you mind? Do you mind? We're going to have the wall. We're building the wall. We're building the wall, folks. We're building the wall.
Aaj jo partiya yahan shor macha rahi hai.
Através do voto, você não vai mudar nada nesse país. Nada. Absolutamente nada.
And the reality now is that we are the party of the people.
Hello there, and welcome to Season 3 of PowCast, the podcast of the Project on Autocratic Legalism, or POW. I'm Fabio de Saia Silva at the University of Oklahoma. POW is an academic network dedicated to understanding how rising autocrats employ the law to consolidate power, sideline political opponents, and govern without constraints, and what can be done to resist those moves, if anything at all. For more information about the project, visit autocratic-legalism.net. My three guests today are Deepa Das Acevedo, Mozin Bhatt, and Mayur Suresh. Deepa is Associate Professor of Law at Emory University School of Law. Her research combines ethnographic fieldwork with doctrinal and policy analysis to shed new light on legal rules and institutions. Besides writing on the law and politics of India, she studies employment regulation and is exploring methodological and theoretical developments in legal anthropology. Mozin is a lecturer in law at Queen Mary University in London. His research focuses on the intersection of law, religion, and politics, with a particular interest in minority rights and democratic practices. His work draws extensively from his field research and human rights interventions among communities in India, particularly on hate crime, citizenship law, and housing discrimination. His ongoing work studies the threats to and resilience of liberal democratic cultures, especially in India and comparable countries in the Global South. Mayur is a senior lecturer in law at SOAS. His research is based on ethnographic fieldwork over terrorism cases that took place in Delhi's trial courts. Prior to becoming an academic, Mayur also practiced law in Delhi, where he and his colleagues represented a wide variety of clients, from women in domestic violence and matrimonial cases, to trade unions in industrial relations proceedings, to property disputes, to criminal defense and anti-terror cases. In this interview, we focus mostly on the piece they wrote to the POW project titled Authoritarianism in Indian State, Law and Society, which was published in 2022 in the World Comparative Law Journal. In that piece, they argued that political change in India under Modi and the BJP does involve a degree of autocratic legalism, according to the conception that we began working with on the podcast and in our project. To concentrate power and govern without constraints, Modi and the BJP do make use of incremental and malicious changes in constitutional and statutory law. But that alone is insufficient to fully characterize the Modi moment and its relationship with law. This moment, they argue, is further based on an ideology, Hindu nationalism, that combines ethnic and religious components and is backed up by mass mobilization. In the interview, they unpack this argument and we debate how it adds to the framework of studies on autocratic legalism, which up to this point, as we all agree, had been too focused on the state and power concentration in the hands of a single individual, the autocrat, overlooking the connections between the state and society and the broader social or economic hierarchies that current authoritarian leaders also have helped entrench. We also discuss the methodological premises of their work, the orientation they share toward law as lived on the ground, which has enabled them to spot these specific dimensions of the phenomenon we have been trying to better understand in our project. And we finish with discussions about the prospects for resistance to Modi and the BJP and attempted predictions about how the story of Indian democracy may unfold. Here's the interview. Deepa, Mozin, Mayur, great to finally have you all on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for having us, Fabio. This is really wonderful.
Hi, Fabio. Thank you so much for having us. It's a pleasure.
I'll start with a broad question about your trajectories. How did your paths cross with studies of autocratic legalism? And how has engagement with this concept and the PAL project been helpful to your attempt to make sense of what's happening in Indian politics and law?
I think it's hard in the current moment to be studying anything related to law or, frankly, politics in India without thinking about issues that are coterminous with autocratic legalism. So for me, certainly, it was a natural, if not pre-planned, area of intervention. Until around 2018, I studied citizen-state relations, democratic sovereignty, and secular governance in India, primarily through the lens of temple management. But lots of aspects of that research converge with a non-religion specific approach to studying the relationship between law and democracy in the way that the autocratic legalism framework allows for.
Trying to think back. So basically, my previous kind of research, or previous slash current research, is on trajectories of anti-terrorism laws in India, kind of the effects of it, the impacts of it, how people kind of engage with it. And I think for me, the kind of the first interest in anti-terror laws came very much in a post 9/11 moment, when kind of India itself used the 9/11 moment to kind of ramp up its anti-terror laws. And I remember when I started working at ALF in Bangalore, in coastal Karnataka, the state where Bangalore is in, there were lots of arrests of people under the UAP, and the place where I worked was doing a lot of those cases. And I think for me, like, then I kind of moved to Delhi and I worked with Jawahar Raja, another lawyer there, in kind of defending one of these organizations, a students Islamic organization that was accused of being a terrorist organization. So I kind of worked with on that case as well. And I kind of got into, and as I practice as a lawyer as well, so I kind of got into anti-terror cases. And I think this the conceptual attraction of autocratic legalism is it provided a way out of kind of the state of exception type framework. In a sense, it took the legal form quite seriously. And I think that was quite an interesting moment. Rather than something like being lawless, well, then the automatic response is that there is laws, at least written down somewhere, right? And we can come later on, I guess, into issues that we have with it. But for the moment, let's just say, I think the framework of autocratic legalism provided a way of thinking about how impunity is enacted through seemingly democratic liberal forms of legality.
Yeah, I didn't start off with a student of autocratic or authoritarian rule at all. In fact, I'm quite the opposite. I, until, say, around 2015, 2016, was basically doing a very optimistic, even wide-eyed analysis of Indian constitutionalism. My PhD work was focusing on Muslims in India and about their legal mobilization, rights consciousness among them. And I think when I look back at that work, it was quite optimistic about the nature of India's constitutional culture. And I think it was quite influenced by what at that time appeared to be some really positive developments in citizenship politics. That was right before Modi came to power. And then when I came back to India, the first set of things I started working on, primarily because I was working with many human rights organizations, was hate crime and citizenship deprivation and the most terrible of things that really challenged my view on the nature of constitutional citizenship, or at least the optimistic take I had on it until then. And I think this more keen focus on authoritarian rule really emerged out of that disillusionment, I suppose, and the struggle to understand what was going on.
One of my goals here on the podcast, especially in this third season when we actually have studies that we produced that we can share and debate, is to guide the audience through the making of those studies, the process by which we have produced them. I think it's extremely beneficial for listeners to contemplate the diverse approaches that we can take when investigating autocratic legalism, and to understand how each of those approaches can lead to different conclusions about the phenomenon that we are interested in. So I wonder if you could share details on the methodology that you adopted to produce your contribution to the PAL project. The article titled Authoritarianism in Indian State, Law, and Society, published in 2022 in the World Comparative Law Journal. How did you go about making sense of the complex and unfolding political reality in India and its relationship with the law?
If I may start, I think my impression was, and we never really spoke about it explicitly, and I'll be curious what the others think, I think the three of us share our approaches or perspectives on the area of study. Mayur's work is heavily influenced by ethnography. He does legal ethnography. Deep obviously is one. I am far less qualified as an ethnographer, but I think I'm influenced by those methods. So I think the focus on the social, the focus on the granularity, on constitutional ethnographic perspectives was something that we rather, in a very unspoken sort of way, shared. And our instincts about what was really at stake in a place like India also, in hindsight, seemed to be remarkably consonant with, with each other. And I think that may also be reflected in eventually the paper that came out and our sort of quite an insider's critique of the autocratic legalism framework.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that all three of us share a fundamental orientation towards looking at law as it is lived on the ground and connecting that with broader theoretical or doctrinal frameworks or institutional structures that are no doubt important, but that often from a traditional legal or even social science perspective can be forefronted at the expense of granular realities, to use Mohsin's phrase.
And just for me to add, I think if I remember correctly, many years ago now, some years ago now, we kind of divided up the paper in terms of thematics, and we really, and that those kind of thematics, citizenship, terror, you know, cow slaughter, those thematics came up from the ground up. So we're trying to kind of build, kind of preface the granular realities and kind of build the theoretical framework maybe ground up and see how the big overall kind of arching theory kind of speaks to what we were talking about.
I guess the next logical step for me after this note would be to ask you to share your findings or to lay out the argument you're making in that paper. But I want to make sure that all listeners have a basic understanding of the context you're analyzing, that we all know what's happening in Indian politics, what Narendra Modi and the BJP represent, and why we should see their role with concern. Could you give us a brief overview of those developments?
I don't know. I guess I'll start with broad brush strokes, and maybe then we can flesh it out maybe with further discussion. The Congress government or the Congress-led coalition government was kind of voted out of power in 2014. And the new right-wing BJP government led by Narendra Modi was elected to power in 2014. I think it was the first time in several decades that one party had a majority in parliament. Narendra Modi famously, or infamously rather, was the chief minister of the state of Gujarat in 2002, when there was kind of widespread, the less put charged term is a riot, but people have called it a kind of a form of ethnic cleansing. At least there was mass displacement of people, targeted killing of Muslim minorities in Gujarat, and the segregation of the cities is still something that we see today as a result of those of the riots. And so he came to power on a very strong there's some debate on what platform he came with, but he definitely came with the baggage of being this Hindu strongman. And so the scholars have basically have talked about a lot of what was happening at the top. That means that the top in parliament, in the Supreme Court, about how they were violating basic rules of passing laws, for example. So Tarunab Khaitan has this article called Killing a Constitution by a Thousand Cuts. So thinking about the different ways in which constitutional norms were kind of bent to the will of Narendra Modi and the party. I think what simultaneously occurred was kind of the unleashing of a very right-wing Hindu nationalist legislative agenda or just a law enforcement agenda at the local state and local district police station level. So one of the things we talk about in the paper is this idea of a love jihad law, right? So anti-conversion laws have been in India for a very long time, but love jihad was a kind of new manifestation of this panic over conversion. The conspiracy theory is that Muslim men are seducing Hindu women and kind of taking them into their fold and impregnating them and creating dozens of Muslim babies, etc., etc. So that's the stereotype of it. So the the Prohibition of Religious Conversion Act, as I think it's officially known, but shorthand we can use Love Jihad Law, was enacted very much in relation to that Hindu nationalistic kind of conspiracy theory, this panic, right? So now, for example, you can't get, if you have an inter-religious marriage, you need permission. It's avoidable marriage. Any third party can come and complain about your marriage. So stuff like that. And you see this in number of places. For example, cow slaughter legislation. That's one aspect, the weaponization of older laws brought in by the Congress government. So, for example, right now, the Congress government had enacted a law called the Prevention of Money Laundering Act. I won't get to the technicalities of it, but basically the Enforcement Directorate, that's the police unit that's created by the act, is being used to target political opponents of the BJP government. And so I'll just stop there, but basically the kind of broad brush, and I'm sure there are other things that happened in India that Deepa and Mohsin can add and talk about.
Another thing that we in the paper took very seriously was the political character of the present moment. Let me just sort of call it the Modi moment in India. So he wins in 2014, as Mayur said. He wins a bigger mandate in 2019. And he is probably poised to win the next general election, which will make him, if I'm not mistaken, the longest serving prime minister by the time he's done with his third term. And we agreed that another important feature that makes this moment important, or if not unique, then noteworthy, is the ideological and organizational background to Modi's rise to political dominance. The ideology is Hindutva, which is an extreme form of Hindu nationalism or Hindu supremacy, and the organizational background is really around this organization called the RSS, which is now a 100-year-old organization, which thinks of itself as the prime mover of Hindu society and sees India, Indian state, Indian society, and Indian nationhood all to be bound together by the notion of Hindu identity, and believes that minorities, particularly Muslims, are outsiders and enemies. And that makes the Modi moment not just about one man or one party trying to be in power, but a larger struggle over the identity of India and profound ambitions of social and political transformations. The idea of entrenching second-grade citizenship, of entrenching Hindu supremacy, and all the laws that Mayur was talking about are in many ways an expression of that form of violence and hierarchy.
And I think all that you just said there about the unleashing of this Hindu nationalist ideology and its connection to decentralized networks, which cut across and are reshaping the Indian state and society, is already leading to your argument in that paper, that what you observe in contemporary India has similarities but also differences regarding the conception of autocratic legalism that we began working with on this podcast and in our project. Why don't you detail this argument for us?
Yeah, sure. So I think one of the areas in which we saw something different happening in India than what the broader framework of autocratic legalism describes is in the diffuse and disaggregated nature of a kind of movement away from democratic norms and the entrenchment of illiberal practices and priorities. Kind of by definition, autocratic legalism is centered on the figure of the autocrat, somebody who, you know, as we say, is singular and central. And, you know, there's no question that Modi and his political charisma and his ability to construct not only a party edifice, but also a political edifice in his kind of own image and with allegiance to him is an important part of the story of what's happening in India. But just as much, and perhaps even more so, this is a story of individual actors, non-centralized movements, an embeddedness of an ideology and a way of approaching the project of nation remaking that isn't emanating from a centralized source. And for that reason, you know, we suggest that something that centers the ideology, the ideological commitments, and the all-encompassing nature of what is going on in India, something that's maybe more akin to what we'd call totalitarianism, is a better way of understanding processes in India.
I guess just to add to that, thank Deepa, that was a really great summary of why we kind of took a slightly different route. I think if I had to characterize a response, it would be a response to Kim Chappell's work as a yes and response, right? So it's thinking, okay, there is this figure of the autocrat, but there's something else happening. And she kind of hints it in his work about, in the work on kind of demonizing minorities, the way in which certain populations are treated by these autocrats, right? And I think this kind of takes me to like the difference in the current Indian moment, because India had a previous bout of autocracy, which is the emergency of the 1970s, right, when Indira Gandhi declared an emergency and kind of took centralized political power. And as I think scholars, were, the difference between that moment and this moment is that there was no centralized, there was no ideology, or there was an ideology, but it wasn't an ideology backed by this mass movement, right? The RSS and the general, the organizations are a mass movement. They have structures, they have people, they have chapters in every locality and neighborhoods. So it's really this mass movement that kind of backs this form of autocracy. And it's this kind of diffuseness of the ideology of how it spreads. It's also a discursive project as well, right? So for example, you see these things in random judgments. And for example, in the paper, we talk about how the police claim that stopping traffic during a protest march is a form of terrorism because it creates panic, right? So it's this logic of security, it's the logic of threat, and the logic of like, bowing down to who represents the nation is something that we're trying to capture through the paper.
Just to add sort of just two minor points. The first is in the paper we give set of examples to show how, I don't know whether in the paper we use these terms, but these are these authoritarian networks, ideologically driven right-wing networks of individuals and groups that for all practical purposes are either hand in glove with the state or at the ground level, it becomes impossible to distinguish where the state ends and these networks, these so-called non-state networks start. And we give examples of how, say, for instance, love jihad laws, which, as Mayur said, are these laws that are meant to discipline young men and women to not marry each other if they belong to different faiths. So how these kind of policing activities happen on the ground. And these what is really happening here, and as we point out, is there's a fundamental transformation in the state itself. These autocratic networks are not being directed from the center. They are really emerging because of this hyper-politicization of the social. They're emerging bottom to top in many ways. And this is not then purely a story of centralization. This is really a story of fundamental transformations in which society and state operate. We don't say it, but more recently I read Christoph Jeffelo, who's a political scientist working on India, and he used this notion called the deeper state. I'm not necessarily endorsing it, but I think the intuition is similar. Basically, what he talks about is how these networks of Hindutva groups have proliferated and have now become part of the network of policing by the state and non-state together. And that is perhaps a similar intuition we have and we had while we were writing this paper, that those are really the stakes of the current moment in India.
When we conduct a case study that challenges a concept or theory, or in which the concept or theory becomes insufficient to describe or explain what we find on the ground, we must face the question of whether or not our case is an outlier. If the case is an outlier, that means that the concept or theory remain valid because they are still capable of describing or explaining most of the other cases. But if the case is not an outlier, if it has enough similarities with other cases, then the concept or theory do have a larger gap, which the case study is actually shedding light on. How unique do you think the Indian case is when it comes to this interplay between law and democratic backsliding that you have documented?
I have some preliminary thoughts, but I'm not sure whether Mayur and Deepa would agree, because we did not obviously take up this question in our paper. I'm usually reluctant to assert uniqueness. I'm not sure whether India is unique at all, but it's a worthwhile question to ask. Now, in the subsequent conversations related inside the PAL project and afterwards, I have started to personally at least feel that the Indian case is not unique, but it may have some features that are more heightened compared to others. So one aspect obviously is ideological, and ideological components are there in all countries. But I think what makes the Indian case compelling is not just ideological, but also material networks. These are not just ideologies of individuals, but these are highly organized, highly motivated groups and organizations and networks that are infiltrating the state and are changing the nature of the state. And I think some of it we see in other countries, and I'm just sort of relying on ongoing conversations in the larger network of people, scholars working in the PAL project. So for instance, scholars from Brazil have written on the notion of zones of authoritarianism, which, among other things, is quite an interesting idea of how there are, we imagine it spatially, but these are sort of places of authoritarian politics in society that get weaponized in service of authoritarian politics of the state. So think of the police and think of what the police does in the favelas and a whole range of sort of other kind of authoritarian politics that happen. So these are zones of authoritarianism. Or more recently, colleagues working on Hungary have pointed out how even if, you know, elections throw up new set of leaders, there is an infiltration or dispersal of ideologically committed individuals who are already part of the state. And then it becomes impossible, even after winning elections, for the new government to change how the state operates. I think India shares these features with other countries, but I think maybe, and there's a question mark, maybe the case of India is perhaps an extreme version of this because of the highly organized character of the RSS and the larger Hindutva movement. But I'll be curious to see what Mayur and Deepa think about it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I have, like Mohsin, an inherent reluctance to name a particular case study as unique. And I'm not even sure I'm up to the task of creating a spectrum and locating India at any given point along that spectrum. Part of the reason that I like Mohsin's way of putting this, that there are dynamics at play in many, if not most, of these country examples, some of which may be heightened in the Indian case, and some of which are less emphasized, is because, you know, as we were talking about the long range embedded, not purely ideological, but also material and social forms of organization that Hindu nationalism and the RSS-led movement in India has been involved in and has led to this moment that we're facing now, I immediately thought of a lot of practices that are pointed out with conservative grassroots republicanism in the US. You know, the effort to essentially infiltrate and dominate low-level school board seats and county offices, these behind-the-scenes, individually unimportant, but ultimately society-shaping functions and positions that have gone on sort of unnoticed for years, if not decades, and are now laying the groundwork for a bottom-up change of society. That, to my mind, is very similar to some of the things that we're seeing in India. Is it different? Of course. But there are similar dynamics of ground-up, not purely legal, not even necessarily political transformation that can be seen in lots of contexts, not just in India.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the thing of not kind of exceptionalizing India or kind of using it as a thing. Other example that comes to mind is in kind of the UK, I get with kind of the whole fomented panic around transgender people, right? It hasn't, and like kind of the randomly you'd have protests around outside libraries where there's transgender, allegedly there was transgender reading day or something like that, right? So it's this, so kind of this kind of local networks of people. I think another example of kind of this, and this is where India might aspire to go, is in the kind of the Uyghur example in China, this kind of this totalizing kind of policing of everyday life. But again, I don't know how much, I just don't know the context well enough. On the surface, there are similarities. I think for the Hindu right at this moment, and maybe this is a controversial thing to say right now, but I think for them, the model was probably Israel. And especially after the kind of the recent events, I think for them, like this whole idealization of it, it's really coming out, right, of how do you create a homogenous society in which there are people who are have different levels of citizenship.
I'm glad that this is how you feel about this, because I do think, and I have written about this, that your paper is providing a contribution to the field of studies on autocratic legalism that is highly generalizable, because it's pushing us to reconsider two premises from previous scholarship about this topic. The first of which was a focus on changes in the state structure carried out through law, and the second of which was, as Deepa pointed out, a focus on power concentration in the hands of a single individual, the autocrat, that was a result of those changes. And what is coming out of your paper is a call for us to look at these phenomena more broadly, to investigate changes in the state in relation to changes and forces outside of the state, and to investigate power concentration beyond just the autocrat, asking how legal reforms help entrench social and economic hierarchies more broadly, all of which can be seen in countries other than India, including, I agree, the United States. I wanted to change gears here, though, and ask you about resistance to Modi and the BJP. How is resistance happening? How effective has it been? And what role has law played in resistance, if any?
I'm happy to sort of say something quite not very optimistic, and then others hopefully will correct me and tell me that I have perhaps reasons for optimism. I think the space or the opportunities for resistance are very dim, and the primary reason, I suppose, or probably primary set of reasons appear to be one, there's very poor democratic or constitutional resilience in any of the major institutions. And as we do point out in the paper, it's not that our institutions were flourishing and they were standing up to assaults in the past, they were already very compromised and India was facing severe institutional decay. So maybe Modi moment is just a culmination of that institutional decay. And I'm not sure whether institutions like courts or fourth branch institutions like the Election Commission or the bureaucracy has or can really stand up. So let's take the case of courts. Courts have practically, and I mean more specifically, the Supreme Court has practically stopped giving any politically meaningful decision against important cases against the government. Say, for instance, the electoral bonds case, which involves campaign finance, which privileges the BJP, Modi's party, has still not been decided and arguably is completely illegal because it introduces these opaque laws that protect the identity of the donors. And enough evidence shows that what more than 90% or 95% of these funds go to the ruling party. Major cases involving certain provinces where their autonomy was taken away, specifically the northern province of Jammu and Kashmir, which is a Muslim-dominated state, and there were procedural irregularities there, arguably because it hasn't been decided. So basically what the Supreme Court is doing is just not deciding major cases or cases with political stakes. All the other bureaucratic institutions, I think, are quite weak now, and they have been compromised. Their appointment process has been compromised heavily. The Election Commission most recently, which is the bureaucratic organization that is meant to run elections fairly, its appointment process has been altered. Again, privileging the role of the government. So these institutions are very weak. The only moments I've seen where there is resistance is protest politics, and the stakes for that are really high because the state engages in extreme form of violent repression. Two recent cases involved citizenship protests and protests against certain agricultural farmer reforms that were introduced. And if others want to pick it up, we can discuss that further. But apart from those instances of resistance, there hasn't been very much. And it's only in those moments of protests that opposition parties or parties that rule other states where BJP is not ruling because it is a sort of a quasi-federal system, that those other political players come in and they can capitalize on the space. But I think primarily that space of resistance is being created or can be created by protest politics, but the stakes for that are high, the risks are really high, and it's never going to be easy to build that kind of resistance because law is not of great help, unfortunately.
What I was going to say, in addition to Mohsin Singh, was kind of the two big public moments were kind of the farmers' movement and the anti-CA protests of 2019-2020. I think what the BJP has actually quite done through a combination of muscle power and also like just squeezing civil society funding is this kind of evacuation of politics, or politics is only located where the BJP says it's located. I was just reflecting over this because recently the Indian Supreme Court kind of rejected a claim for same-sex marriage. And in the past, when for example, on the decriminalization of homosexuality, that was kind of reversed by the Indian Supreme Court, there was a big protest. There was a national meeting, right? There was something happening. There were protests in different cities. And I was trying to think about why that didn't happen this time. And I think it's for two reasons. One is that politics, or kind of the political activity, has moved out of the streets for some reason. The reason being primarily the heavy hand of the police and stuff. And also the second reason, simply because there is no funding anymore, no money anymore to actually do the work. It takes money to print out pamphlets. It takes money to organize buses for people to come in, right? So I think that was one thing. I think, and I was kind of reflecting this. I'm doing a series of interviews with lawyers, civil liberties lawyers, as part of this new project. And there's a kind of active debate on the role of law. And there's one camp that, and I'm caricaturing it a bit. One camp that says, you know, there's no point in law. We need to be in the streets. And that's one response. Another response, which I thought was, or the two other times for responses. One is that we must keep the space of law. The courts, we cannot give that over to the executive. We can't give it over to the Hindu right. And there's a third one which basically says that that, you know, they will make mistakes, right? There will be contradictions, and so what the autocrat hopes will happen through a law is not something necessarily that unfolds on the ground. So, for example, and one way I think Mohsin will probably know more about this is that the combination of the Citizenship Amendment Act and the National Register of Citizens, it was quite explicitly done to strip Muslims in the state of Assam of their Indian citizenship, right? But because it's a bureaucratic process, because it's a judicial process, what actually happened was a number of Bengali Hindus ended up being at threat of having the Hindus, of having the Indian citizenship stripped, right? And kind of the BJP, and that kind of contradiction led the BJP to stop. And it's left millions of people in a limbo, right? And so it might not be resistance in the form of protest or in a form of you know, a direct action campaign of whatever sort, or for example, going to court and demanding our rights. But it's kind of making use of a form of space that's inherent in legal processes. So it's not a good place to be in, obviously, being 2 million people being a threat of having their citizenship revoked. It's not happy for anyone. People are still being detained. People are still not having access to kind of welfare services. But there is, I think, this creation of space and this use of that space to whatever limited to of the contradictions implied by created by these legal forms.
I'm going to keep my comments here limited, partly because I think this is a empirical question that Mayur is the best situated to answer because he's actually been doing the work. But it strikes me that one theme in the responses and the coverage that I'm noticing sitting far away is that the sense that previously we could address inequities or lack of functioning in the Indian state via the mechanism of the courts and formal law and the constitution, that sense has largely, although not completely, eroded. I think the reaction to the recent ruling on same-sex marriage shows that there was still some hope hanging on that was disappointed by the outcome of that particular case. And so what that means for a country that has, whose progressive elites have largely relied on constitutional mechanisms, particularly litigation, to drive maybe not everyday change, but symbolic transformation for decades at this point, is that those alternative spaces and mechanisms that Mayur was pointing to become more important because the last leg is no longer there. That, like he said, is not a good place to be. But that also doesn't mean that there is no window for change anymore. It means that the new form that resistance and the articulation of an alternative vision for the country, those things have to come from a place that we have probably not identified yet.
If I may add one more thing to Mayur and Deepa's excellent comments, and maybe there should be a reason for us, while thinking about how law and resistance are entangled, is to maybe distinguish, I don't know how viable this is, but anyway, distinguish legal institutions from sort of legal imagination and legal discourse. So even though, as both Deepa and Mayur have said, legal institutions appear to be weakening, and maybe the future means that these institutions are not going to revive in terms of their potential and capacity to resist, but at least what I've seen on the ground, whatever extent I have, the Constitution and law and rights and democracy continue to have a lot of traction among people who are resisting. So that discursive power of the law in mobilizing, in creating shared frames, and even shared strategies, even if they may be extra-institutional, I think is quite compelling. And my own feeling is that that might not change because the language of resistance seems to continue to rely heavily on the progressive potential of the progressive imagination of the Constitution, because there's no other language to fight the regime, which can be shared by so many people.
I have to say that the more I read and learn about India, the more I think it's both fascinating and scary. Because of all authoritarian projects in the world, and there are many as we know, I tend to think that India is one of the most successful. This picture that you presented about the ability of opposition groups to resist Modi and the BJP is at best a mixed one. I recently saw polling data in which Modi had the highest approval rates of all leaders in the world. Growth rates for the Indian economy have also been among the highest, if not the highest. India was recently ahead of the G20, which speaks about its growing global influence. Biden has been courting Modi as he sees India as a potential counterpoint to China. Given all these factors, how do you predict that the story of law and democracy in India will unfold? Is it going to inevitably move toward a more closed regime? Or is there any hope that the Modi time will lose traction and Indian democracy will be reconstructed?
I don't know. Maybe instead of a prediction, I'll say a hope, right? And maybe like a qualified hope. So my obvious hope is that the BJP loses the next election. I don't know if that will happen. I doubt it. But I think what the kind of the glimmers of hope are that they have not been sweeping state elections, right? There is a kind of fight back at the state level. And I think just from what kind of the opinion piece I've been reading in the media is that the charisma of Modi does not operate. So that's, I guess, a hope. I guess my fear is that even if they do get voted out of power, the legal structure, the discursive structures are so endemic and some sense embedded in society that it almost might not make a difference who's in power. And just to give an example, I think there's something to be said about the fact that even opposition politicians, places like West Bengal, there was an argument made about the chief minister of the state of Karnataka, are kind of embodying kind of these autocratic tendencies in their small fiefdoms. But even that apart, I think the fact that you have just the kind of the discursive language of hate, of, you know, or just the fact that you can lynch people at will almost is something that I fear will remain. Sorry, I wanted to start end on a happy note, but I can't.
Well, I'm not going to predict, completely incapable of doing that. And I agree with Mayur's sort of assessment of possibilities. Maybe sort of throwing in another set of possibilities is that obviously there are certain politicized agenda of Modi and the BJP. But there's a lot of other stuff that is going on, right, which creates a highly centralized, opaque, violent state. Well, how does the Indian state deal with people's data? How does the Indian state cultivate crony capitalism and permit, you know, monopolies and facilitate monopolies, which destroys small business and destroy sort of local government accountability to sort of range of things, because now there are new corporations that are coming and taking control of things. I think those economic questions, the political economic questions, are there in the background, and they are in many ways central to what this regime is doing. Obviously, the regime doesn't want people to talk about that. And quite often, they want people to constantly just talk about religion and religious polarization. One possibility could be that those massive changes in the nature, in the political economic nature of the Indian state, reach an inflection point that it just creates a whole range of people who are unhappy with those changes and therefore challenge the way Modi and BJP and RSS are framing politics. That will not change the entrenchment of graded citizenship in India, but that might open up a new set of potentialities and opportunities for creating a different kind of politics. It's very difficult to guess what may happen, but we have to acknowledge that the regime is on many parameters failing on economic sort of standards. It's not creating enough jobs. There are massive population of young people who are desperate for livelihood. There is arguably growing economic discontent in many parts of the country. So there are a range of things that are happening. It's impossible to predict in what way they will get entangled with each other and create opportunities for the future.
I think I'm sort of constitutionally, to use an apt word, predisposed against making predictions of that sort.
Well, since you listen to the podcast, you know that before I can let you go, I have one final question to ask. What would be the one or two key readings or resources that you would recommend to our listeners who may want to know more about all that we discussed on this episode?
So I'll start with a plug for a couple of Mayur's articles that front the role of courtroom trials and the way they allow us to understand essentially the social life of law in contemporary India. So he has a 2019 piece, The Social Life of Technicalities, Terrorist Lives in Delhi Courts. There's a sizable body of work that accompanies that piece that looks at the courtroom as a space for kind of insight and intervention into Indian law and politics, but I'll pick that piece out in particular. The citation, which I do have, is volume 53, issue 1 of Contributions to Indian Law and Sociology, 2019.
Thank you for that plug, Deepa. I was going to suggest, for students of politics, probably work by Christophe Jaffelot. I think he has a book on comparing the two emergencies, which is quite insightful. I was actually going to go further back in time, and I think it's been a heavy read. Hannah Arendt's On Totalitarianism. I think that is probably where I'd go with this, is kind of comparing that moment or her idea of totalitarianism and Stalinism and the Nazi in Nazi Germany with India, and as a way of understanding what's happening.
Maybe one person I would add would be Thomas Hansen's recent work. His larger body of work, he's an anthropologist, and his larger sort of body of work is on identity politics, political mobilization, religious mobilization in India. And he has a recent small book called The Law of Force. I think the full name is Law of Force, The Violent Heart of Indian Politics. And I found it quite useful. It's a short read, but I think it problematizes the nature of sovereignty and violence in Indian politics, and I think struggles in productive ways to figure out in what ways the current moment a continuation from the past, and in what ways is it different.
Deepa Das Acevedo, Mohsin Alam Bhatt, Mayur Suresh, thank you all for being here today.
Thank you so much for having us, Fabio. This is wonderful.
Thanks so much, Fabio. And thanks for curating this conversation and inviting us to the PAL project.
Thanks, Fabio. Always a pleasure to talk, and good to be reunited with the co-authors. Always a pleasure to be talking to them.
If you like this series, please share it with your friends on social media. They can access our episodes on the main podcast platforms or on our website. And if you have any feedback to our episodes or to our projects, please drop me a note at fabio.desailsilva@ou.edu.